All right. Well, it's good to have everybody with us this morning for office hours. I've gotten a few questions about the exam and hopefully have been able to respond to those satisfactorily. Remember, it is out of a, the score is out of 100 points, not 150, which is the way it may appear on Moodle, because remember there were six questions and you only had to answer four. So each question is worth 25 points. For some reason, it's not as easy to get the site to automatically display the fact that you got two freebies. In other words, two questions don't count. So remember, whatever your number is, your raw number of marks divided by one, on a 100-point scale represents the grade. And be sure and look at Grayson's note called midterm scores, which you'll find on the site, which explains this in standard English. So anyway, I was very pleased with the scores that were reported, and I'm very pleased with what you guys did on the exam. That'll help you found the experience not too terribly painful. Again, it's sort of a good that's a good time to kind of check your knowledge and understanding. If there are any things that you were uncertain about, as you looked at my sort of comments and hints and suggested answers, this is a good time to make sure that we're all on the same page, that we all understand things in the same way. So again, remember that exams are not only for scoring, but really just not so much for evaluating you, but also for you to check your own progress. A couple of notes on next week. There's an announcement that Grayson has posted that our Tuesday lecture will begin 30 minutes later than usual. And that's because next week is the Mises University Conference in Auburn, and I'm scheduled to give a lecture to the Mises U crowd right about the same time that we normally start our course lecture. So we're just going to bump that back by 30 minutes, but otherwise keep everything else the same. Also, if you look on Moodle, you'll find some very exciting readings that are posted for next week's course on the corporation and the state, or business and regulation more generally. A lot of our discussion will be centered on the corporation because that's where a lot of the interest is, but we also want to talk more generally about how the state interacts with entrepreneurs, with firms of any legal form, with firms of any size, because there are a lot of important issues there that we've touched on during the semester, but haven't had a chance to treat in a more systematic fashion until now. So, that having been said, I'm just going to open it up to any comments or questions that you guys may have. There were a few things that came in. Let's see, there was something that came in last night about about things to discuss. But go ahead and feel free to shoot me anything that's on your mind here in the chat window, or to send me an email. And I'm just gonna let you guys lead the discussion today. I'll go with the flow. Okay, a question for Alicia. Have we had any homework besides responding in the forums? No, we actually haven't. Just the only deliverables we've had so far is participation in the lectures, commentary on the forum, on the forums, and the midterm exam. We'll have a final exam as well. Thanks for reminding me, Alicia. I should clarify this in the forums. Early on, we considered having some writing assignments, maybe for you guys to do individually or to do in small groups. But it really, given kind of the flow of the course as it's gone over the last few weeks, it seems like we've got plenty to do and we're keeping plenty busy. I feel like I have enough to make assessments of how people are doing. So we really haven't had anything to turn in, any questions to answer, or any papers to write or grade. And probably in the next 2 weeks we won't have any more either. So I apologize for any ambiguity on the syllabus, but no, I don't think. Well, you haven't missed any homework, Alicia, and I don't see the need to have any more written deliverables. I feel like we've had really good action, really good discussion on the forums and during the classes. But if anybody really wants to write a 25-page paper and have it, as part of their as part of their score for extra credit, let's talk. For the right price, we can come up with anything. Okay, Jim has a question about M&As. Yeah, Jim's asking a great question. Remember the discussion in chapter 3 of the book about M&As tending to come in clusters by industry and by region at different periods of time, typically in response to specific external shocks, mostly legal and regulatory shocks, though to some degree technological shocks and maybe shocks in the international competitive environment as well, and how during those periods we tend to see a lot of, well, let's put it this way, that's much greater uncertainty about the future than what entrepreneurs would face in the absence of those kinds of shocks. And so we would expect the process of experimentation, entrepreneurs experimenting with different combinations of heterogeneous assets, as we've said many times this semester, to be more aggressive in a sense, that entrepreneurs will have to do things with a lot less certainty about the future than might otherwise be the case. And so we would expect a lot more reversals, a lot more corrections, so to speak, a lot more recombinations that occur later. So look what's going on now in very important industries, specifically in financial services, right? Look at the Dodd-Frank bill that was signed into law yesterday by Obama. The most radical comprehensive reform of financial services since the 1930s. I mean, already we've seen firms react in some rather odd ways. For example, the credit ratings agencies. There's only three in the U.S., S&P, Moody's, and one called Fitch. A little-known aspect of the U.S. financial system, or a rarely discussed aspect, is that there's only three because the government has allowed there to be only three. In other words, the SEC has a specific kind of certification. I forget exactly what it's called, to be a licensed, securities, licensed and approved securities ratings agency. There's some specific term that I forget now. You have to be approved by the SEC. The SEC has only approved three. So basically, there's a three-firm cartel of ratings agencies, a government-enforced cartel. So not surprisingly, they're not very competitive and not very good at what they do. But these agencies immediately responded to the law going into effect yesterday by announcing that they would not provide any ratings, and that they were asking lenders not to use their bond ratings, as part of the offer, as part of the information given out and trying to float the bonds, because the ratings agencies are worried about their legal liability. One of the provisions of the new law is that the ratings agencies can be sued if investors or other market participants, invest resources relying on what the credit ratings agencies say, and then the bonds turn out, the bonds go into default even though Moody's rated them as double A or something, then disgruntled parties can sue Moody's. And so the credit ratings agencies said, we're not going to do anymore until we get this figured out, and we're going to refuse to allow our ratings to be used by firms as they and other entities as they float their bonds. In response to which the bond market sort of shut down yesterday morning because no one wanted to float bonds without a rating, and the ratings agencies didn't want to provide them. I mean, this is just one simple example of how any major change to the regulatory status quo introduces a heck of a lot of uncertainty. Now, My point is not that, for that reason, we should always maintain the regulatory status quo. I mean, if the regulations are really bad, we should improve them. We should repeal, we should liberalize, we should deregulate, and so on, even though that means some disruption, right? I mean, the status quo isn't always, the best. But even in that case, we would expect in response, even to improvements in regulation, there to be some errors that are committed around that time, right? Or moves that in hindsight will appear to be errors. You can think of any industry like the transportation industry in the 1970s, which was deregulated in the US under President Carter, or largely deregulated, the trucking industry, for example. We saw a lot of M&As in trucking. We saw a lot of vertical disaggregation in trucking. We saw a lot of reorganizations of many different types, some of which turned out, in hindsight, not to be wise moves. But that's because the trucking industry had been organized a certain way for many, many decades because of very strict federal regulations on interstate transportation of goods. You remove those restrictions, you're going to have a shakeup. And we would expect to see a lot more reorganization a few years down the road in response to that shakeup. And that's exactly what I would expect, Jim, in response to your question, in response, in following the Dodd-Frank bill and other things that are going on, that have been going on in the last couple of years in financial services. Right, I mean, automobiles might be another example that in response to global competitive pressures, also, environmental regulation, of course, government policy towards bailing out large firms. We've seen these big restructurings in the auto industry with companies like Fiat in the EU, for example, greatly expanding their reach, Chinese players becoming bigger participants in the world market, private equity firms taking big stakes in some large manufacturers like Volvo and so on. You would expect that General Motors, for example, would behave differently, knowing that it really will get bailed out if push comes to shove by the U.S. government. Right? There was a kind of an implicit guarantee against bankruptcy that has now become a very explicit guarantee against bankruptcy. We would expect GM to behave differently than it otherwise would, and maybe to take some risks that it might not have taken in the past, knowing that the taxpayers, are on the hook for covering any losses. Again, this isn't always in the response to changes in government, a response to changes in government policy. It could be a response to technology shocks, as we saw in the tech bubble of the 90s, the internet bubble, which was partly a response to government policy in very low interest rates and credit expansion by the Fed. Right, so part of the tech bubble in Silicon Valley and elsewhere in the 90s was kind of classic malinvestment in the sense of the Austrian business cycle theory. But part of the reason why it happened there in IT, in technology, rather than some other industry, transportation or housing or whatever, was because there were real technology shocks, rapid changes in technology as a result of the internet, the growing commercialization of the internet. Rapid technological improvements that lowered the cost of hardware, lowered the cost of communications, broadband, and so on. So that's why that also contributed to the bubble being in that sector as opposed to some other sector. Okay. So Jim, I hope that that's a very long-winded way of saying yes. The answer to your question is, in my judgment, yes. Grayson asks about what Robert Higgs calls regime uncertainty. I mean, absolutely yes. There's no question about it. There's even some recognition in the mainstream press. I saw an article recently about this. Just by way of background, for those who, if you haven't read Robert Higgs' research on the 1930s, it's extremely valuable. He's an economic historian whose most important book, Crisis and Leviathan, was published in 1982, I think, maybe it was 1985, about the rise of government in the US in the 20th century. One of Higgs's major arguments, and you can just Google Higgs regime uncertainty and get some summary pieces of his argument, is that One reason the depression in the 1930s lasted as long as it did is precisely because, the radical changes in the huge expansion in the role of the federal government under FDR, in the New Deal, and the constant changes in how New Deal policies were structured. The NRA, National Industrial Recovery Act, and the National Recovery Administration, had this radical cartelization of manufacturing sector, only to be struck down a few years later by the Supreme Court. The fact that Roosevelt was constantly introducing new things, and that business people could not predict what the new rules would be, how long they would last, when Roosevelt would change his mind again, that, according to Higgs, created a climate of uncertainty in which people were very reluctant to invest. So business investment, Higgs point out, just looking at the data, private business investment remained extremely low throughout the 1930s. And part of the argument, he has a lot of documentary evidence from what business people were saying at the time, quoted in newspapers and correspondence and so on. They would say, "Well, I'm not going to build a new plant. I'm not going to start a new company. I'm not going to introduce new products. I'm not going to expand my activities because we have no idea what those bozos in Washington will do next. They may expropriate my factory. They may double the tax rate. They may set up a new cartel. You'd have to be crazy to invest under those conditions. I'm going to sit back and wait and sort of see what happens." Well, Obama's stimulus, Obama's regulatory reform, the Financial Services Reform Act we've just been talking about, I mean, according to Higgs and others, this also creates a climate of regime uncertainty that is hampering the recovery today, right? That today firms are reluctant to invest because they don't know what crazy thing is going to come out of Washington, D.C. next. And it's not too different, in the EU and elsewhere in the developed world as well. Yeah, thank you for the link. Grayson has just put a link in the chat window. Wouldn't make an excellent case study. And again, there was a piece, if you go to the Independent Institute's website, or the Independent Institute's blog, it's called The Beacon. I'm pretty sure within the last couple of weeks, just Google regime uncertainty on The Beacon blog. There was a great, there was a little article with some a couple of lines from the Washington Post or somewhere where some practitioners, not having read Higgs or whatever, were saying exactly this, that we're afraid to invest now because we don't trust Obama or we don't trust the U.S. Congress or we don't trust the Federal Reserve System or whatever. So yeah, I think there's no doubt that's a contributing factor as well. I mean, this is just a teeny bit off topic. Some of you who have been taking other Mises Academy courses on the business cycle have probably discussed this in great detail already. But, in explaining a phenomenon as large and important as, say, the Great Depression of the 1930s, or even the current recession, as Austrian economists, we're not necessarily looking for, the one smoking gun, right? One simple and straightforward factor that is the sole cause of everything, right? I mean, looking for just one cause, that's gonna your search is inevitably going to be a disappointment. And some critics have said, well, the Austrians claim that credit expansion leads to malinvestment and a big crash, but that isn't enough to explain how a depression could last for 8 years as it did, or depending on how you measure, 10, 15 years as it did in the 1930s. The Austrian theory can't, isn't enough to explain that. Or they say, well, come on, what happened in the last decade? Sure, there was credit expansion, but that isn't enough to explain the housing bubble. You have to also bring in all these other causes. Well, I mean, the Austrian response would be, exactly, fine, and that's no problem. The claim is not that, the lengthening of the Hayekian triangle and so on is the unique and sole cause of every single aspect of every boom and every bust. It's one factor, a particularly important factor, but there are other contributing factors as well. We already mentioned, IT innovation in Silicon Valley being a contributing factor for the boom and bust of the 1990s. I think in this course earlier we mentioned, government policy towards housing, the role of Fannie and Freddie and the Community Reinvestment Act and all these other things, which also were contributing factors in the housing boom, right? In the 1930s, you had, right, the Austrians have a good explanation for the boom and the initial crash, but to explain the severity of the Great Depression in the 1930s, we need to go beyond the kind of textbook Austrian business cycle explanation, you know, to explain why recovery took so long. They say, well, it's because of Keynesian macroeconomic policies. You know, they weren't called Keynesian at that point because they were before Keynes, right? But, you know, massive stimulus and further credit expansion, you know, deficit spending, cartelization, the NRA, and so on. Those were all, if you add those on to the Austrian business cycle, you have the boom, the bust, then exactly the wrong policies in response to the bust, and you get a huge drawn out, you know, you get the worst recession in modern history. So we want to look at a variety of contributing factors, and I have little doubt that regime uncertainty is playing a role today in you know, hampering the recovery that we might otherwise have had. A couple of people have written on the, you know, the Great Depression that wasn't, referring to the boom and bust of 1920-21. There was a very sharp recession, a big stock market crash and fall in output, increased employment in late 1920, early 1921, with a very quick recovery. You know, within six to 9 months, the economy was right back to where it had been before. So a very sharp crash followed by a rapid recovery. And, you know, nobody's ever heard of that anymore. It's not in the history books because there was no Great Depression in 1920, 1921. The reason was because the government did absolutely nothing to try to stimulate recovery, right? The government cut spending. There were no big stimulus programs. There was no regulation. There was no new monetary expansion. And as a result, the economy, you know, healed itself extremely rapidly. Okay? So that's an example of how, you know, you can have a boom-bust cycle in the classic Austrian sense, you know, that doesn't lead to a huge bust because the economy is allowed to recover on its own. Right? So ask your friends if they've ever heard of the Great Depression of 1920-21, and when they say they haven't, you can, you know, show them the data on the stock market and look at the big stock market crash that happened then. Ask them to explain why there wasn't a recession, even though the government at the time didn't do anything that, you know, the Obama administration, Ben Bernanke, and other people say we need to do now. Oh, yeah, Jim's pointing out that some of his clients are making this argument, too. That's great. I'd love if you have any, you know, if you can provide some quotations or tell a few stories, you know, while disguising the personal details, it'd be great to have some of those to share, Jim. I'd love to blog about those. And Grayson's also pointing out that in Bob Murphy's business cycle course, that's right, there's a difference between a bust and a depression, meaning that... you know, when the cycle bursts, when the bubble bursts in the Austrian sense, you know, the appropriate response from the Austrian perspective is to reallocate those malinvested resources to more valuable and profitable uses. Right now, because of asset specificity, that reallocation is not instant. It doesn't happen in a day, right? But it can happen more or less quickly depending on what happens. What the sort of policy response to the bust could be. So the point that Grayson's making, quoting, summarizing Bob Murphy's point, is that a bust does not necessarily lead to a depression. If by a depression you mean an extended period of low output, you know, high unemployment, and so on, the depression is caused by a lot of other things. The bust sets the stage for the depression, but government policy prolongs, you know, makes the bust into a depression. The book by Richard Vedder and Lowell Galloway called Out of Work, published sometime in the 90s, is a good explanation, provides a great explanation of this as well. There's also a very prominent neoclassical economic historian, labor economist at UCLA named Lee Ohanian, who's just in the last year or two published a a paper in the Journal of Political Econ I think it was in the JPE, a very prominent mainstream economics journal, arguing that labor market regulation, that the New Deal, the NIRA, etc., played a huge role in explaining the length and depth of the Great Depression. He's basically reproducing the argument made by Murray Rothbard in America's Great Depression by a veteran, Galloway, and Out of Work, and even cites them favorably, using some more, modern quantitative empirical techniques, but basically coming up with the same argument as them. Okay. Let me check my other email account here to see if I'm missing anything. These are all great, great questions. Okay, anything else? Anything else you've seen in the news lately about entrepreneurs, about firms? Anything from the readings? I'm sure that you guys are just, soaking up every word of the capitalist and the entrepreneur essays on organizations and markets, and hardly ever finding anything to disagree with, or being confused about any passages because they're so beautifully written. But I'd be more than happy to entertain questions, comments, objections, to deal with psychological problems that have resulted from reading the book. If you have any questions about different parts of the readings, not just the book but other readings, don't hesitate at all to ask about them. Okay, Grayson has a quote here from Man, Economy, and State. Rothbard uses the term uncertainty discount. The greater the doubt about the usefulness the stick will have after it's ready, the less likelihood of investing in it, the more likelihood of investing in another good or consuming it instead of saving. There's a sort of uncertainty discount on the expected future utility of the investment that may be so large as to induce the actor not to make the investment. But by the way, Grayson, if you can add the link to the part on the full version so people can look at the context. I haven't used that particular term, uncertainty discount. Yeah, thank you. It's near the very beginning. It's where he's talking about sort of fundamental concepts of action, preferences, utility, time, investment, and so on. I mean, look, the economic actor, whether a consumer or a business person, a capitalist entrepreneur in our sense, right, is always making investments in the face of uncertainty, even if it's just investing our time, our reputation, and so on. And we've talked, for the whole semester about how entrepreneurship can be conceived as the act of making these investments, entrepreneurship in the broad sense, right? And how, in the face of uncertainty, entrepreneurship is inevitable, right? Because there is no automatic, guaranteed return on investment, whatever. Hence making entrepreneurship central to all, a central aspect of all of human action. Now, some of the things that we haven't talked about in detail are, exactly how do entrepreneurs more generally, and capitalist entrepreneurs or entrepreneur promoters more specifically, what are their personality traits? What are the sort of cognitive, psychological, behavioral characteristics that make some people better at doing this than others, right? Warren Buffett has better judgment about securities markets than I do. Why is that? Is it genetic? Is it a learned behavior? Does it have something to do with, was he dropped on his head as a baby? Jews really don't know, right? But what Rothbard is getting at here is that some of us are willing to bear moderate levels of uncertainty, but would prefer just to sit things out when the level of uncertainty is too high. Right? Remember in our example from Tuesday's lecture, we were talking about takeovers and LBOs and so on, and this argument that some mainstream economists have made that the disciplinary takeovers won't happen in equilibrium, because shareholders will always refuse to tender their shares to the raider because they anticipate that the raider is trying to turn the firm around and eventually will make it worth even more than what the raider is currently offering, so the raider can earn some profit. People won't be willing to tender those shares, therefore the raider can't acquire control, the takeover will never happen, and so on. Right? We pointed out that not all investors will want to stick around for the ride. Right? Some may prefer the bird in the hand to the two in the bush and will accept the offer made by the raider because that's cash in hand, right? And will not want to wait and see if maybe a few years in the future the stock might be worth even more than what the raider is currently offering, right? So that's a case, in a sense, a kind of example of what Rothbard is talking about here. Meaning, if uncertainty about, if uncertainty about whether the investment will pay off is sufficiently high, some market participants will prefer to go for a less uncertain or a lower risk investment. Right? It's no different from, somebody, burying gold coins, in the backyard, or putting his money in the bank, or buying a 6-month CD, as opposed to investing in potentially a higher return but more risky assets, right? So if you want, I don't use the term uncertainty discount, but one way you could characterize that is to say, if uncertainty about equity returns is sufficiently high, then some market participants will simply avoid equity markets altogether and will prefer to put their money elsewhere. I guess the general point I'm making is that I have found it more useful, at least in this stage of our discussion and given the context of what we're doing this semester, really to talk about, fundamental Knightian Misesian uncertainty in general, and what agents bear this uncertainty and what are the implications of true uncertainty for the firm and for the behavior of organizations and so on. Now, we could go further and talk about different degrees of uncertainty, a lot, a little. One problem with that is it's not obvious how one, you can't put uncertainty on on an obvious scale. It's not clear how you would parameterize or quantify, more or less uncertainty, because uncertainty is subjectively perceived in the minds of human actors. So, but there might be particular applications where it would make sense to talk about there being more uncertainty, less uncertainty, to what extent the uncertainty discount, as Rothbard puts it, is so high that people who otherwise would want to be entrepreneurs, to act entrepreneurially, reduce their amount of entrepreneurial action. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a useful concept in some contexts, but it hasn't come up a lot for the issues we've been discussing this semester. But I'll certainly think about it, and I'd urge you guys to think about it too, how it might apply to vertical integration or innovation or other things that we're interested in. Yeah, thanks, Jim, for a link to a Wall Street Journal piece by Ohanian. And I think, yeah, this is a great piece by Ohanian and a colleague, Harold Cole, How Government Prolonged the Depression. I think he has, yeah, I'll see, let me just quickly see if I can find a link to the famous article that I'm thinking of. Let's see, here's his website, papers, let's see. Yeah, I think it's his. I think it's this paper from the Journal of Economic Theory. What or who started the Great Depression? Let me make sure that's the one I'm thinking of. Ba-ba-ba. Sorry, guys. Yeah, this is the paper I was thinking of. I'm not sure if this is the most recent version, but if you want the, if you want to see the technical version of the paper, check out the link that I just sent. It's got a lot of math in it, but if you want to see, what it would look like when a, sort of mainstream neoclassical economist is making a very Austrian argument, what it would look like. What else we got going on here, folks? Oh, excuse me, just one second. You done? Okay, thank you so much. Alright, bye-bye. Okay, yep. Had a student taking a makeup exam. Okay, other questions, comments? If anybody has audio or video and wants to join us that way, given that there's only four of us, so we should be able to accommodate audio and video for more than just me, if you want to add it. Okay, Jim has a question. What do I think about employee-owned firms? I'm all in favor of them. On the free market, I would expect to see employee-owned firms, as well as shareholder or investor-owned firms. We'll talk about this, Jim, a little bit next week in our discussion of government policy toward organizational form. One of the points, actually, that I make in the little exchange with Roderick Long is that, think of all the different possible kind of ownership or governance structures that one could have in a market economy, proprietorships, partnerships, investor-owned firms, like corporations. Or there's also a category of what I think more broadly we could call patron-owned firms. Things like cooperatives and patron-owned firms include employee-owned companies. One of the local grocery stores here in Columbia, Missouri, where we shop, is an employee-owned grocery store. One of the major rental car companies, I think it's Avis, used to be an employee-owned firm, maybe it still is. You can also have producer-owned firms, like a farmer's co-op, right? A processing plant, so a lot of ethanol plants in the Midwest, for example, are jointly owned by the farmers who sell corn or whatever it might be to the ethanol plant for processing. So that's a case where the firm's suppliers, if the ethanol plant is a firm, right, the firm's suppliers own the firm, and they own it, their share of ownership is a function of how much they sell to the co-op. You could also have a buyer's cooperative. Again, it's common in agricultural areas where, the local store where the farmers buy seeds and so on is often a customer-owned store. So employee-owned, supplier-owned, producer-owned, customer-owned, those are all examples of what we might call patron-owned organizations. Are they legitimate in a free market? Of course they are, absolutely. One of the things we'll talk about next week is whether the investor-owned firm, particularly the publicly traded, joint stock company, is sort of especially privileged relative to patron-owned organizations like employee-owned firms. There's some discussion, a lot of libertarians have argued exactly this, that in the absence of, state subsidies for big companies, we would probably have a lot more employee-owned firms, a lot more patron-owned firms of other types, smaller, flatter organizations, more sort of in-home production, so-called cottage production, as opposed to the factory system with its big division of labor and assembly lines and so on. My position on that is that, in a free market, I would anticipate, certainly people would be free to experiment with many different organizational forms, including employee-owned and other sort of patron-owned organizations and cottage production networks and so on. Empirically, do I think it's likely that we would have a lot more of those than we have now? I don't know. I'm more skeptical on that. And part of the reason is there are some straightforward economic arguments, independent of government policy, about the pros and cons of different organizational forms, right? Patron-owned firms have some advantages and some disadvantages relative to investor-owned firms, right? The argument, the standard argument is that that their main advantage is because they're in a sense flatter, You don't have the kind of principal-agent problems that you have between, with investor-owned firms, right? So the patrons of a patron-owned company are closer to the firm, right? I mean, you buy from the co-op or you work for the employee-owned firm or whatever, you have more of a stake in its behavior and outcome. You have better knowledge about what's going on inside the firm, relative to, a guy who owns 5 shares of IBM, doesn't know or care anything about IBM specifically, but just, is wanting to add that security to his portfolio. So the argument is, the owners of an employee-owned firm or patron-owned firms more generally have bit stronger incentives and better information about monitoring and governance and so on than do the owners of an investor-owned firm. That's one advantage, right? It turns out there are also a lot of legal and tax advantages. Farmers co-ops have antitrust immunity, for example. They're taxed at a lower rate than corporations. But even throwing that aside, there, on the other hand, are some serious disadvantages to employee-owned firms relative to investor-owned firms. Jim mentions one here in the in his comment, right? That workers might not, employees, customers, suppliers may not want to be owners, right? They might prefer to have more of an arm's length relationship with the firm. They might not want so much of their personal wealth to be tied to, the firm that they in fact are doing business with as well. Right? I mean, sort of standard lesson for diversification, right? If you're an employee of IBM, do you want all of your or a huge part of your retirement portfolio to be in IBM stock? I mean, you might want some, but you probably don't want all of it because if IBM goes bust, you don't want to not only lose your job and lose your wage income, but also, lose the value of your retirement fund. You want to be a little bit more diversified than that. So first, patrons, whether they be customers, suppliers, employees, may not want to be owners in the 90-in sense. They may not want to bear that uncertainty. Second, it's employee-owned firms and patron-owned organizations more generally face a higher cost of capital than do investor-owned firms. I mean, it's simply more costly for them to raise funds. In the case of farmers' co-ops, for example, they can't float stock. So if they want to expand their operations, they have to get more patronage. So if you're employee-owned, to get more capital invested in the firm, you got to hire more employees. Or get existing employees to invest more of their personal wealth in the firm. It's much easier if you're a joint stock company to simply sell stock to, unaffiliated outside investors. That's one thing. Also, there are some organizational advantages to separating ownership and control. In the kind of agency theory, Burley and Means literature, it's always assumed, it's often taken for granted that, separation of ownership and control is somehow inefficient. It's a sort of a bad thing. But no, it can also be a good thing, right? Because patron-owned firms face a number of drawbacks associated from the tight link between patronage and ownership, right? So, investors in a patron-owned firm have different preferences over what the firm should do. Right? Should it expand? Should it contract? Should it sell this? Should it sell that? Should it, have this technology or that technology? So you have to have some kind of collective decision-making mechanism by which the patrons can make these decisions. So there's a whole layer of collective action problems that has to be sort of folded in. One of my colleagues here at Missouri has done a lot of research on the organization of cooperatives, and he also points out there's what he calls a horizon problem. Namely, that patrons, depending on where they are in their career cycle, may have different preferences with regard to sort of the life cycle or temporal objectives of the organization. So older members, right, would prefer to get a higher rate of return now, right? So they're more concerned with the short-term performance of the firm, whereas younger patrons, younger employees or younger customers or whatever are more interested in the long-term performance of the firm. So one group wants a higher dividend, the other group wants more, wants dividends to be reinvested in, firm growth and so on. It's hard to resolve these conflicts when the people who actively manage the firm are those who themselves, have these different horizon issues. That can lead to a lot of conflict within the firm, right? Also, the fact that the patrons, the employees, the customers, the suppliers, they have so much of their own personal wealth tied up in the firm. It's hard for them to separate their kind of retirement issues from other day-to-day management issues. They can't diversify their personal wealth, and so you have what you might call kind of a portfolio problem associated with the firm. Again, we'll talk about this a little bit more next week. The general point is there are potential organizational and governance drawbacks of patron-owned organizations, even if we ignore any differences, pros or cons, in kind of the legal or regulatory, tax apparatus. So it is not at all clear to me that in the absence of the state, everything would be organized as a co-op, or we'd have lots and lots of employee or owned firms. If that's really better somehow, more efficient. It's not clear to me that it's more efficient at all. It has some advantages, but it has some disadvantages as well. And, we'd have to see how the market process kind of sorts that out. Grayson's also pointing out here, if we think about kind of specialization and comparative advantage in skills or attributes, right? I mean, look at my relationship to Walmart, right? I purchase goods from Walmart, but I only have an arm's length relationship with Walmart. Suppose I'm somebody who buys a lot from Walmart. Does that necessarily mean that I have capabilities or skills in management or in entrepreneurship, in uncertainty bearing, and so on? Clearly not, right? So why would you want those making decisions about the firm's operations, those making investment decisions, to be the ones who happen to buy a lot from the firm? I mean, those may be two completely different functional, two different economic functions. And it's not obvious why one person would be particularly good at it or relative to someone else, right? Employees may not be good managers, right? Suppliers may not be good directors. Customers may not be good investors. And so it's not obvious why you would want to combine consumption, employment, patronage in some other form with operations, with investment, with entrepreneurship. Jim, that's a long way of saying, I have nothing against employee-owned firms, and I wish them well. I don't think that they can compete really with corporations in every industry. It's an organizational form that works well in particular circumstances, but I don't think it's in general has huge advantages over any other particular organizational forms. Okay, anything else, guys, that's going on? Other questions or comments? Let me see if scroll up, see if I missed anybody. Jim, I didn't address your point about the business cycle specifically. Might employee-owned companies promote wage flexibility by linking compensation to profits? It's possible, but again, you lose this kind of portfolio diversification effect, right? That when profits are down, the real wealth of employees is down too, maybe in ways that might exacerbate rather than mitigate fluctuations over the business cycle. So, again, that's kind of, I think that could go either way. It's not obvious to me that that's a huge advantage. But again, like I say, a little bit of a plug. We have some good material on this for next week. And actually, that reminds me to add a reading. Okay, other questions or comments? I can imagine some furious typing in the background, though I can't actually see it. As I mentioned, the other day, I hope that we actually did find some useful summaries of the new law, the new financial services regulation. Well, in fact, I posted it on Organizations and Markets, but here, let me just show you again. It's sort of a pretty neutral, useful summary of what's in the law and some different features. So if you're interested, you might want to check out the link that I just added, and maybe we can have some discussion on the forums of specifically how the Dodd-Frank Act is likely to affect corporate governance and corporate control, specifically, or other aspects of the theory of the firm and the theory of the, sorry, firm behavior and entrepreneurial practice. More generally. So again, I haven't read through the dang thing and have not studied all of the details. I'm skeptical that this is going to lead to some huge efficiency improvements in the economy. This summary line from the link that I just posted, the writer says that the Dodd-Frank Act affects a profound increase in regulation of the financial services industry. We knew that. The act gives U.S. governmental authorities more funding, more information, and more power. In broad and significant areas, the act endows regulators with wholly discretionary authority to write and interpret new rules. Isn't it shocking that legislation like that would ever get past the U.S. Congress and be signed into law by the president? Because they're usually so reluctant to increase their budgets, to take on any new regulatory power. But shockingly, this has gone through. So, I mean, it may be years before we have figured out what what the effects will be. Okay, great comments and questions. Anything else? We have we I can stick around until for the next half hour, but if you guys are satisfied, we can always knock off a little bit early, but I'll give you some time to keep thinking and reflecting and maybe typing. Meanwhile, I'm going to take a look at the syllabus and make sure I added everything I wanted to add for next week. Okay, Jim, does regime uncertainty raise the relative profitability of political entrepreneurship compared to market entrepreneurship? That's a fantastic question. By way of background, what Jim has in mind by political entrepreneurship, and Jim, feel free to correct me if I'm stating this incorrectly, is that we can think of specific actors behaving in an entrepreneurial fashion. In the mixed economy, right? So, for example, take the Kirchnerian notion of of entrepreneurship as opportunity recognition or opportunity discovery. There's a nice article by Randy Holcomb from a few years back that takes an explicitly Kirchnerian perspective on political entrepreneurship and says, okay, you know, say I'm a congressman and I want some particular bill passed because it feathers my nest, it helps my constituents, it gives me more power, whatever, but I don't have enough support in Congress to get my legislation passed. Well, you know, there's some other congressman who wants some other piece of legislation passed. Well, I recognize, where perhaps other congressmen don't, that if I join forces with this other person and I agree to support his bill, if in exchange for his willingness to support my bill, we can both get our bills passed, right? And maybe other Congress people don't recognize this opportunity to join forces to get this new legislation created. So there's a sense in which the politician there is acting as a Kirchnerian entrepreneur, you know, in a non-market setting, namely recognizing opportunities to achieve gain, opportunities that are not recognized by other potential participants. The gain, of course, in this context, is not profit. It's not money profit. It's not economic value. There's no value being created for consumers, necessarily. The gain is purely political, right? It's measured in terms of power or prestige or perks for this politician, or money for the politician or for the politician's friends, whatever. But if we generalize the notion of profit to include, you know, power and so on, to be gains more generally, then we could think of political actors, non-market actors, behaving entrepreneurially, acting as Kirchnerian entrepreneurs. Maybe they're Knightian entrepreneurs in a sense as well, right? That, you know, the head of the, well, I mean, look at Mr. Bernanke, right? I mean, he does control resources. Federal Reserve has huge, you know, physical resources, buildings, gold, right? It has financial resources, obviously. Now, he isn't the owner, so he isn't an entrepreneur in the sense of being a capitalist entrepreneur. But, you know, he might be kind of a proxy entrepreneur. He exercises some delegated or derived judgment. In other words, he has to make decisions about how the assets, resources of the Federal Reserve System will be invested in pursuit of uncertain goals, uncertain returns. Again, what are the returns for Bernanke? Prestige, reputation, power, maybe money, favor of other people, who knows? Personal satisfaction. Whatever Bernanke's goals may be, he has to make decisions about investing resources in pursuit of those goals, and there's uncertainty about whether those goals will be achieved. So you could say, well, that's kind of like Knightian entrepreneurship, too. Obviously, there are important differences between this kind of entrepreneurship and, you know, real market entrepreneurship, right? You know, gains and losses are not measured in money. So these political entrepreneurs or non-market entrepreneurs can't use economic calculation. There isn't a kind of filtering mechanism. There isn't a profit and loss system to engage in kind of selection between good and bad entrepreneurs, as there is in the market, right? So a congressperson might not be particularly good at engaging in political entrepreneurship, but because you never know for sure whether the gains and losses, how the gains and losses materialize, how they're realized, and maybe this political actor can sort of fool other people into believing that he's been really successful, right? I mean, anytime a new law is passed in the U.S. Congress, right, there's a signing ceremony, and there's the president, you know, signing the thing, and behind him is arrayed this gallery of prominent Washington insiders. There's the Speaker of the House, and there's the majority leader or minority leader, and they're all smiling and holding hands and singing Kumbaya and all that, right? Basically, those people are all trying to take credit for what they hope their constituents will see as a great success. You know, who really was responsible for the political success of that act? I mean, who knows? It's very difficult to tell. So there's a lot of persuasion that must go on, and it's very different from the kind of feedback you get under, in a market setting. Another important difference, obviously, is that political entrepreneurs can use coercion, right? They can use coercion to acquire resources, and they can compel the consumers, quote-unquote, you know, to patronize their organization. So, you know, we wouldn't look at the Internal Revenue Service and, you know, say it's been successful because it has more customers. No, I mean, you have to patronize the IRS whether you want to or not. Or the guys in military gear will come to your house and haul you away. So my point is, there is an analogy between entrepreneurship in the market economic sense and entrepreneurship in a kind of policy or political sense, but we don't want to take the analogy too far because there are extremely important differences between market and non-market action. Now, Jim's question is, does regime uncertainty raise the relative profitability of political entrepreneurship? Well, I mean, it certainly creates more Kirchnerian opportunities for political entrepreneurs, right? I mean, if you're, imagine that Peter Klein becomes dictator of the United States, or more likely, Peter Klein becomes the king of Liechtenstein or something, and is a complete laissez-faire dictator, right? And so overnight, Klein repeals all kinds of business regulations and sets tax rates at zero, and complete economic freedom and political freedom and so on, except that I still get to be the dictator. So there's no there's no regulatory structure. Well, a lot of opportunities for political entrepreneurs, in the sense that we're discussing here, come from, lobbying, right? You lobby the regulator to get regulation that passed, it's in your favor. Well, if there are no regulators, right? If there are no spoils to be handed out, then there's no point in lobbying, right? So if you think of lobbying expenditure as kind of an investment made by the political entrepreneur in anticipation of getting some returns, well, there are no opportunities to do that under Klein's dictatorship because there are no government favors being handed out, right? So there are fewer opportunities for political entrepreneurship in that sense. And if you want to think about, rates of return or potential gains from political entrepreneurship, under the Klein dictatorship, those returns are very small. There's not much gain to be had. So we would expect less of that activity to go on, right? So clearly, in an interventionist state, particularly one that is nominally democratic, like the U.S. or the EU, I mean, those are huge, vast opportunities to engage in political entrepreneurship. Maybe, there's a slightly different kind of political entrepreneurship that happens even in dictatorships, right? So, there are different people you have to bribe, but at the same time, there are opportunities to realize gains that other people can't, right, by working the system. So the more complex the bureaucratic system is, the more opportunity for political entrepreneurs to sort of work the system. So Jim says, now I'm thinking more of private sector entrepreneurship that takes advantage of changing political regulator conditions rather than the real conditions of consumer demand and resource scarcity. Okay, so I didn't exactly answer Jim's question. Yes, I think there are opportunities under regime uncertainty for private market participants. Is that more or less quantitatively than the opportunities, or are the potential gains bigger or smaller than they would be under other conditions? I'm not sure how to weigh that exactly. But yeah, I mean, I think we talked in previous lectures about Enron, right? So and how Enron's major source of competitive advantage was the fact that the CEO, Kenneth Lay, was a former U.S. Energy Department official who really understood the regulatory apparatus better than his rivals. So, and under a big regulatory state, right, private for-profit entrepreneurs who understand regulations better, who have good connections in Washington and so on, have advantages that other people don't. So clearly there are opportunities both in the big regulatory state in general and anytime the regulations change, as in regime uncertainty, for people who are politically savvy. What about that guy? I forgot what his name is now, the guy who founded Blackwater, the private military company, that's changed its name now. I can't remember what the guy's name is, but I mean, he's certainly, he's a market entrepreneur or a for-profit entrepreneur in the sense that I think, I mean, that his firm is privately owned, and I think really what it cares about is money. I don't think that the Blackwater investors are doing it for, just because they get a warm, fuzzy feeling out of, going around the world blowing up stuff. Now, maybe some of the employees of Blackwater are doing it not purely for financial reasons, but I don't think the investors, I think they just want a high rate of return on investment. But, you know, clearly, with the U.S.'s great increased involvement in the Middle East and so on, increased reliance on outsourcing those kind of functions, State Department, even the Army and so on, outsourcing things to private military companies, that does create increased opportunities for profit-seeking entrepreneurs who know how to do that stuff and who are politically connected. So yeah, Jim, no doubt about it, rent-seeking private market participants have increased opportunities for gain through the political system when the state is very large and when there's rapid change. Now, I'd like to think that you know, in the absence of regime uncertainty, in the absence of the large state, those individuals could put their skills to use looking for pure market opportunities by serving consumers better, right? And would they be as good at it? I don't know. But I mean, clearly these are bright people. I mean, Ken Lay and the Blackwater guy, I mean, you know, they have skills, and they might be good at being, you know, real entrepreneurs if they didn't pursue the kinds of things that they currently pursue, which is not the case, by the way, for political entrepreneurs as politicians, right? I mean, I always think it's funny that people say, well, you know, politicians don't ever get into it for the money, because you don't get paid that much to be, you know, salaries aren't that high for congressmen or agency heads or even the president, and these guys are really smart, they can make lots of money, you know, on Wall Street. I think that's baloney. I mean, Bill Clinton is a very bright guy, but Bill Clinton, Al Gore, whoever, I think those guys make vastly more money as former presidents than they would make in any line of work they could have chosen outside of politics. You know, getting $1 million for a speech, and Al Gore making, you know, bazillions of dollars by investing in alternative energy companies and so on. I mean, yeah, you don't make a big salary when you're the agency head or when you're in Congress or when you're the president, but you make a shitload of money once you get out. And I think people like that do vastly better under the regulatory state, even in a purely financial sense, than they would in a free market. Okay, let me look more at Jim. I hope that gets at what you're asking. Grayson asked a question about Mises here. Let me read this. Yes, I agree completely with what Grayson has said in his three comments up here, blurb here, that, again, when we talk about the profit that accrues to the political entrepreneur, when we talk about exchange that political entrepreneurs engage in, you know, log rolling in Congress, I'll support your bill if you support mine, that is a kind of a trade, right? But these things are outside of catalactics in the narrow Misesian sense. What Mises means by catalactics, you know, market activity in a private property system. So again, you're right, Grayson. What I mean is things like profit, concepts like profit, price, entrepreneur, we might find them useful as if we apply them by analogy to non-market settings, but it's only an analogy, right? The gain to the politician is not, strictly speaking, profit in the Misesian sense. The rate of exchange, how much do I have to support your bill to get you to support mine? You could think of that as a relative price ratio. But again, simply by analogy, those are like prices, but they're not strictly speaking prices in the Misesian sense. So I agree absolutely. And Jim has made a reference to Rob Bradley, who's an economist who specializes in energy policy, energy regulation. Actually, Rob is the one who sent me my highly valued Enron tote bag. He has a great book on Enron, and he uses the concept of political capitalism to explain the kinds of things that we're talking about now. And I would highly recommend Rob Bradley's work in this area on how in highly regulated systems, entrepreneurs, both real entrepreneurs and these sort of entrepreneur-like politicians, how they can realize their objectives by manipulating the political system. You know, in terms of nomenclature, you know, is the U.S. economy today, is it capitalist? Is it really more like political capitalism? I mean, the answer is yes to both, right? I mean, we have a huge and highly complex mixed economy with some real desirable capitalistic features and many undesirable political capitalistic features. You know, I guess it's sort of you know, it's a matter of labeling or classification as to which one we say dominates the other and how we might compare it to other countries, other economies, the U.S. economy elsewhere in time and so on. But clearly, yes, there's a heck of a lot of non-market entrepreneur-ish activity that's going on. I should mention, just as a clarification, something else that is outside of the scope of catalactics, narrowly speaking, following on Grayson's point, is also the purely benevolent activities of, you know, sort of philanthropy, so-called social enterprise, and so on. So a philanthropic organization, a charity, a church, you know, a social club, you know, they also, you know, act like entrepreneurs in a sense, right? Just as a joke, I attend a church here in Columbia, Missouri, that does not, we don't own our own building, and we've looked at potential buildings to buy, but we don't have enough money to buy a really beautiful one, and we don't want to buy something that just looks like a warehouse. But there's a beautiful and very old Anglican church, Episcopalian church here in Columbia. They have a beautiful sort of Gothic-looking building, but they don't have any members, right? As some of you know, in the U.S., the Episcopalian Church has been lo Episcopal Church has been losing members left and right. You know, there's a lot of controversy about you know, gender issues related to the clergy and homosexuality and so on. There's a lot of splits. You know, I sometimes have joked with our pastor that, you know, gosh, if we could just encourage the Episcopalians to quit and encourage their church to break up, maybe they would put their building on the block and we could acquire it on the cheap. Right? I've even thought about going by the Episcopal church on Sunday mornings and putting little flyers on people's windows. You know, are you dissatisfied with the church hierarchy in the U.S. Episcopal Church? You should quit and join this other church, right? You could say that's kind of entrepreneurial, isn't it? Right? I mean, I see a potential opportunity for gain that maybe other people don't see. I think that by investing my time and energy in persuading people of that church to quit, I'm only kidding, of course, about all this. You know, we might be able to invest in our group might be able to buy this building for less than we otherwise would, and realize a huge gain in terms of the quality of our services and the experience of being part of our congregation and so on. Now, this is not catalactics, right? Because these gains are not measured in profit and loss, and not measured in money. We can't, you know, there's no money, profit, and loss. None of what I'm describing is, strictly speaking, entrepreneurship in the catalactic sense. At the same time, you can, you know, you can see the analogy, right? And it might be useful to talk in the terms of this analogy from time to time. But also notice, you know, I'm not talking about any coercion. So I'm not talking about using the state to you know, to, I'm not using eminent, talking about using eminent domain to seize this property that I want, to coerce people to quit this one organization and join another. It's purely voluntary. So it's part of the free market in the sense that it's voluntary, but it's outside of the price mechanism. Okay. So my point is, all non-market entrepreneurship is not necessarily coercive and not necessarily, you know, value destroying in, you know, kind of in the Rothbardian sense. But, you know, again, someone who had, you know, who's managing a church or who's managing the Mises Institute or the Red Cross or Doctors Without Borders or any group like that still faces some organizational and managerial problems associated with things like performance measurement. Because, you know, you just don't know how to measure gains and losses in the same way that you do if all you care about is the monetary bottom line, okay? All right, guys, it's almost 10:30. And I think on that, with that fairly interesting example, it might be a good time kind of to wrap things up. So I will call our discussion, I'll call things to a close for now, but look forward to seeing you guys for the lecture on Tuesday. Again, if you joined us late, Tuesday's lecture will start 30 minutes later than usual, so 6:30 Eastern Time rather than 6 Eastern Time. And there are some readings for you to look at for next week. And let me know if you have any problems accessing those or any questions about them. So, great to be with you guys this morning. And let's continue these discussions as we always do on the forums. See you later.